Dublin, and they talk about a version of the finite difference approach that we've been using for MT modeling and version control source. And a vital contributor to this presentation is my colleague Michael Comer. I'm from Lawrence Berkeley Laboratories in Berkeley, California. So I'll go right to the fundamental equation we're going to solve, and unlike Andy Mackey, or Collins, I deal directly with the electric field. And I'll just state it, it's just B two curl curl E. This assumes that E to the I omega T time dependence harmonic, and right hand side is zero, conductivity, magnetic permeability. And we use the concept, I'll tell you, to solve this equation, we're going to use finite differences. We're going to approximate it with finite differences. We're going to use the staggered grid. I'll explain what that is and how we implement it. I'll discuss initially some boundary conditions. At the end of my talk, I'll really talk about boundary conditions because this is really fundamental with frequencies and periods that Alan likes to work at. It is a big issue. It cannot be swept under the rug. And then I'll tell you about how we do the conductivity average. This is the concept of the staggered grid after U, 1966. For the younger students in the audience, probably he was around before you were born, so we're still using his work. And so this is a classic paper, so maybe one day, if you're lucky, your paper will be cited 50 years after you write it. Basically, this is the Maxwell's equations in differential form, time harmonic, for electric field, magnetic field. And we have the constitutive relationships for current density, magnetic induction, which also implies the divergence gauge condition must hold. Staggered grid is we have a block of stuff, which we assign a conductivity and magnetic permittivity property. And when we discretize the equations on the staggered grid, we assign the, in our case, unlike Randy, we assign electric fields on the edges because everything is tangentially continuous and we don't have to deal with the problem of jump discontinuity. So we basically punt it. Okay? So we didn't want to deal with the jump conditions on E because conductivity is primarily the prime we're interested in this talk. If it were magnetic permeability, then we'd have to use proper and normal component averaging of H on the if we went after the permeability. But in our case, it's going to be constant. So basically, we assign E to the edges of the cell, B to the faces, and then you remember from the surface law, in this case, Ampere's law, curl of A would be curl of H linked to the normal component of the current density, in this case, EZ times sigma on the edge. And you can just think of these loops propagating in space as you just the system. Well, even with the standard grid efficiencies, we seek an even higher level of efficiency because the types of models considered is that we're going to be looking at conditions to make sure that the calculations on the simulation grid are accurate, but we have to be able to model basin scale geological problems, and this can lead to extremely large meshes and all the problems that go along with grid stretching and all these sorts of effects. So we're going to look for an additional approach to be able to tackle this problem by discussing different types of grids. We're going to introduce a modeling grid, which the modeler sits down and designs his model on the basin scale as fine detail as he wants. Okay? This is what you're going to show to the geologists. However, we're going to design the simulation grid on a different grid. We're going to call it omega S. And this grid will vary for the frequency receiver set, but it'll be optimized. That grid. Okay? So what will happen is that the simulation grid will be based upon skin depth consideration that can be much, much coarser than the underlying modeling grid. And this will lead to faster solution times. Now what's required is we need a mapping from the modeling grid to the simulation grid. The modeling grid describes conductivities on the cell world. The simulation grid describes conductivities on the edge world. Okay. Also, if we're going to do the inverse problem, we need to go from the simulation grid back to the modeling grid. So again, simulation grids are edge-based conductivity based on.
Why is the conductivity on omega S edge-based?
That's the finite difference staggered grid.
Oh, okay.
So the conductivity on omega S is on the edge. Conductivity in the modern grid is the cell base. And I'm going to show you what the appropriate mixing law is now. Everybody remembers from their high school physics course about parallel series circuits, where you had to use Kirchhoff's laws to derive voltages across a current flow in a series parallel circuit. And that's basically the concept here. So what we have here is a dashed grid. Each dashed grid is an underlying modeling grid. And it's much finer than these big, heavy, dark grid here, which is the simulation grid, okay? Now, in the simulation grid, we need the conductivity on the edge, okay? Sigma X here needs to be on. Well, to be able to get the effective conductivity on the edge of this cell on the simulation outlined here, on this edge here, we need to do some sort of averaging, material averaging, that would take the conductivity on the modeling grid and map it to the edge of it, okay? This is the basic parallel series circuit mixing law. Basically, what you do is the inner integration is basically does an integration along the conductivity in this direction. The outer integration is you move along the edge. This is the parallel circuit current flow. This is the series. Okay? So this allows you to effectively decouple with the proper physics, and this is the important thing, is that you are not a prisoner to the very fine modeling grid when you do the simulation. You can decouple it. You use this mixing law and then carry out the simulation on the simulation grid with a much coarser grid, but with the proper aggregation or upscale. And that's the key.
So this is just for the X component, sigma X. You'd also do it for Y and Z as well. After we do the material averaging, we assemble a sparse complex symmetric linear system. S depends on the MT source polarization. We have two for each frequency. To find the impedance tensor, we solve this with an iterative Karloff method. Quaternion residual, you can use biconjugate instead. We also employ the static divergence correction Swift to improve convergence at the longest periods. You see what magnetic fields after you get the electric fields. Determined from a numerical application of Faraday's law. Word code is parallelized over the model simulation grids and frequencies. So the test case, if you look at the 3D test model, I call it the Dublin model, 21 frequencies, we consider the model decomposed over 180 cores at 21 frequencies, and you've added resources, you could run this on 3,720 cores to get the solution if you're in a hurry. Or
is that what you have available, 3720?
If I really want to use it, yes,
okay.
But I
didn't know if
I
that related to
that
your model grid, or that's just what you have available. Okay.
Actually, it depends. It's your flexibility.
Okay.
So you could run it on 64 cores and use any data parallelization. Ideal method for problems with extremely large data sets and model parameterizations and some of the systems the code is implemented on. Here is the test model. We're all familiar with it. Marion sent out. Now, what I'm going to discuss now is boundary conditions. But before I do that, I want to talk about coordinate systems. This is dual. I like the right-hand rule with Z positive down.
Yeah.
You people apparently like it this
nope.
way.
Okay.
Fine.
It's still Z positive down.
Yes,
I'm left-handed.
Well, to clarify here, basically, if I want to go from mine to yours, I have to take my impedance sensor and do this effect, this coordinate rotation, okay? And lo and behold, I have to flip the signs of my impedances and then interchange the diagonal element. Thanks to my aunt for clarifying that. But that's the rule, so please remember that.
dub and test model from 10 hertz down to 10,000 seconds, 10 to minus 4 hertz. This is skin depth in kilometers. These are the cell sizes based on a fifth of the skin depth. And then the mesh size, such that you would have about, in this case, I believe in this case, something like about 5 skin depths, 10 skin depths out. So a mesh size at 10 hertz corresponds to with this sort of cell, skin depth, about plus or minus 8 kilometers. And as you drop the frequency, the size of the mesh has to be moved out because of the sensitivity to the boundary condition. The attenuation, not, you don't attenuate the field. The field will become more and more sensitive to larger and larger regions. So at the lowest frequency, you're looking like a cell size of 100 kilometers, okay? Or a mesh size of 2,500 kilometers. That's about a third, more than about a third of the Earth radius. So impacts, you should start to consider the curvature of the Earth in these long period models. You need to kind of do
these sorts of calculations. Of course, we're not going to simulate with those grids because they're too extreme.
So there's a lot of numbers. Just bear with me and I'll show you the salient points. Frequency, these are the meshes that we've used in the calculations. The minimum mesh sizes in X, Y, and Z, maximum mesh sizes, the time of solution, and the iterations. To make a long story short, all of this calculation took about 2 hours and 49 minutes on 64 data cores. We didn't use data parallelization. Typical solution per source polarization was about 3 to 4 minutes. But this is the grids that we used, and what we did was right around 1 hertz, we just decided to deliver a 1 kilometer maximum cell spacing for the longest periods. And at the minimum cell size, as the frequency went up, we had to refine the vertical complement to get accurate results for the at the highest frequency. And in fact, here we had a little trouble getting the convergence to converge the tolerance that we wanted, 10 minus 12, and that accounts for a good chunk. This is a bad grid. You could have done better by continuing to work the mesh. The point here is that in these examples, we ran these meshes out to 80 kilometers on a side. However, we did some tests with the boundary conditions, and this is really important because this is with the 100 ohm-meter half-space boundary condition, and that's with the 10 ohm-meter half-space boundary condition. And you can see right below 100 seconds, respecting the boundary for an 80 kilometer spread out grid starting to become important. So when we blew this grid out to 160 kilometers, I believe that gave us another decade. But the point here is, if you do not know your boundary conditions in these longer periods accurate enough, they're really going to adversely affect your calculation, no matter how accurate your code is. Okay? So, and you're not going to have, who can say in this audience they have that information, they know what's going off at infinity, and they're going out measuring their data? Or when you try to compose that into a modeling program.
What do you use for your boundary conditions?
Just a half space.
Oh, and this is the test. The test is the way that you say that the boundary conditions affect when you treat it is that the result should not depend on the boundary condition. So right here, I gave it the wrong boundary condition, and the results agree fairly well down to 100 seconds. That's good. I don't want to be captive to the wrong boundary condition.
So you have to do these tests to make sure that the calculation is not sensitive to the boundary condition, or either what your action.
I think if you went to like a 2D boundary condition, it would be a different story.
How do you know what's going on at infinity?
I know.
So my.
You don't know, but you're not concerned about a 2D on the scale of your model. A 2D captures the information that you need.
You have to specify it. You don't have the. I claim it. You don't have the information. Okay.
What information do you need? You're concerned with the electromagnetic fields in here. If there's some discrepancy out of the boundaries 100 kilometers away, who cares?
I just don't want to adversely affect my solution.
I I propose that it doesn't.
I propose here that it does.
Well, because you're using a half-space boundary condition.
I
use 2D boundary. Use 2. Just try it.
We can discuss it. Everyone in the audience can make a point on this. Is that this is a valid point of discussion? Is that I don't know what's going on off at 100 kilometers outside of my core domain. So I would be. And you're saying that if you change your boundary conditions, that it doesn't make any difference.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying I think I can believe that if you use a half-space boundary condition, that's going to have a big impact on the fields. Yeah, I believe that. I'm just saying I think you could. I bet you that if you went to 1D or 2D boundary conditions, even it wouldn't impact it as much. That's what I'm.
Well, my point is that any sort of modeling and inversion interpretation I ever do, I always make sure that the results are not going to be dependent on the boundary conditions, and that's making sure that the grid is out far enough that when I change the boundary conditions, it doesn't change to some sort of tolerance calculations within the core part of the grid, and that's how I deal with it. Okay.
Great, but you're talking about modeling, not about inversion, right?
Well, you have to do the same thing for inversion.
No, but I mean, is it so important for modeling, boundary condition? Because for modeling, you know your boundary condition, for forward modeling.
Well, yeah, but the point is, we're living in a fantasy world. We're given this little synthetic test bottle, all right? And they give us this nice boundary condition. We can shrink the grid and be all happy that we got accurate results. Well, wait a minute, okay? We really have to think about this. We really have to deal with the, in the real world scenario, we don't know the boundary conditions. Or for modeling, if you want. You don't know. So,
yeah, you're right. I mean, the problem with FT is you're dealing with perturbation of regional flowing currents.
You don't.
And it's that 3D regional structure that's coming into your modeling domain. And it's how it comes in. And I think Randy's got a point that, you know, it's going to come in a very homogeneous nature that's very unlikely to look like a house.
It's fine. The question is, though, then you have to. The point here is that you have to make your problem independent at the end of the boundary conditions because you do not have that information out there. Okay, you don't have it. You may convince that you have it, but you don't. So maybe what Randy says is that you're much less sensitive, and this is a more extreme case. Okay, in terms of the sensitivity of the calculation, but it's the problem's still there, I contend.
Well, if you go 2,500 kilometers from most places in the Earth, you know, the oceans are very good boundary conditions because you've got high, you know, so quite long period fields that are trapped in the ocean layer.
Right, but then so they're very skin depth wise at the longest periods, are very thin skin depth. You're also seeing signal coming down from deeper structures in the crust and mantle, too. But yeah, granted, you would consider that. It's just something to think about, okay? This is a case of the apparent resistivity for the other polarization, same issue. Phase, same z, x, y, impedance phase, same issue. And for the other, and I'll stop there. But in any case, question.
So I'm trying to understand these two plots again. So you're saying that on the right-hand side, where it goes all purple, that's
where effectively they start to diverge.
That's where it's wrong.
Well, that's the effect of the boundary condition, the wrong boundary condition present in the calculated impedance. Okay, so it's being adversely affected by it.
But how far away is that boundary in terms of skin depth? Are you like 3 or 4? Is that boundary sort of like 3 or 4 skin depths?
We terminated at 80 kilometers on each. It's 160 kilometers on a side in this case. One way to make this agree better at the longer or lower frequencies, I'd have to move the boundaries out even further. Okay. But then the problem is that your face is that you really want to capture this fine detail in your model, Alan, at about a kilometer on a side. Then you're left with a trade-off. So, well, I have to get the grid out there, then I'm going to have to introduce stretching, and that's going to cause problems with the accuracy of the underlying calculation. So choose your poison.
Yeah.
The point is, accuracy is more important than anything else. So move the grid out, and just move it out until you don't really are sensitive to those boundaries, and then you can go around happily model away. But this is an extreme case, just that people should be made aware of.
The requirement would be 10 or meter, if you would put one meter or...
Yeah, you can do any one you want. I mean, that's just one I just chose. Look, it's down to 100 seconds, everything's fine, doesn't see it, effectively. But after that...
So this all depends on what you put there, right?
Right. So, I mean, but if you know the ocean, yeah, then use it by all means, but beware.
The figure isn't going to vary very much if you put one. The point is that, you know, at 100 seconds is when you're seeing the boundary.
Right.
So it's wrong. Anything different from 100, you could have made it 1,000, we'd see
different picture,
that we'd see below 100 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so move the grid out, and you'll be okay. But that's all that. And granted, what Randy says, more boundary conditions probably make it less extreme.
My old advisor, Ted Madden, used to be concerned about the very same thing. So he was really trying to sort of a multiple scaling approach, saying, let's do the big picture, include the ocean, include everything, but on a big grid, and then use those as boundary values on
what should be done.
Yeah, but the question is, you must should be very confident what it is out there. Okay. The other point here is that this upscale and this mixing law really allows us to do very fine modeling in the domain which you're interested in. Okay, but very efficiently. Okay, and so we can more effectively treat these sorts of extreme problems that you encounter in the world of NT. All deference to all your good work. No, you don't need to. Okay, and the reason why is that there is a null space solution in the air, and it's a gradient of a scalar potential. Okay, and normally if you're looking at magnetic fields up there, you're going to take a curl and it'll go away. Or if you're not going to be computing up there, I don't care. So basically, it'll find that solution up there when you solve the system. Some addition, it'll have the electric field plus this unknown gradient. But if I'm not be calculating impedances up there, I don't care. Problem. It's not a problem. In spite of what Eldad says, it's not a problem.
Well, his big thing is the curl has a null space, which is true.
Right.
That's
so
true,
what?
But that doesn't mean Maxwell's equations have curl operators, but I bet the EM fields in Europe don't stop to think about there's a null space.
No. I'll come back and say you've got a bunch of data you have acquired and you want to do forward model trial and error matching of your data. Then you're going to have to impose a boundary condition. Then you have to make that choice. That's right. Given all the other things we have to worry about, okay.
But it should be connected with the accuracy of impedance, I think, because you see, you have 52, it is, I don't know, blue,
apparently.
And then
apparent
in
phase.
Venus,
that's
right. Right? Then green is, okay, 48 is green. So accuracy 5%, so difference between curves at 5%.
Well,
so
that's been cropped. Anything about where violet, anything above 52 degrees is just made violet.
So cut off?
It's cut off. So. But that's not accurate enough, because in terms of the inversion of this test model that Ariane gave us, you've got to get at, you've got to really, really converge to within less than 1% in order to be able to start to extract all that information in the model. That's why boundary conditions are important.
I guess at some point someone will want to start to talk about inversion. That's when we talk about dynamic gridding. I know that your supervisor is a very smart guy because they have different size grids for different frequencies.
Of course,
yeah, in fact,
that's a bad grid.
Okay, then
that's about a factor of 5. Okay, and that's a lot. I have to understand is that my iteration is a very, very cheap iteration, because basically it's just a matrix vector product of a sparse matrix. It's very nice.
Oh, like 50 kilowatt iterations?
No.
2,000 kilowatt iterations?
For a simple Jacobi precondition, it's very fast. You can go into all sorts of elaborate preconditions if you want, okay? And it depends on what sort of resources you have. But usually, you can tell that the convergence of the problem is well done, is well conditioned if you see with a simple Jacobi. That's all you need. You can do it within several thousand. And it's the same thing applies with the
simple Jacobi. No.
Simple Jacobi. You just do it once.
No.
Because the trick, though, is then you have to be very careful in your grid design, all right? And that's where this grid separation idea is critical, because it allows us to keep uniform grids, okay? But then we can have very complex underlying modeling, modeling problem, which you really are interested in presenting to your geology friends in the mining industry.